Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour on Twitter. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Business, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on water wells going dry when we come back. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you pay $7,650 a year in Social Security taxes. Then you pay an additional 17% income tax on that same $50,000. That's another $8,500. Now, that means that you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. And that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's being advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Just call and ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, tax and status, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click on the email machine, and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about this thing of the depreciation or the decline of our aquifers, not just the aquifers in the United States or the drought going on in the western United States to be concerned about, but a worldwide problem. Now, if you're like I am, when you were a youngster going to school, they taught us that the aquifers were like a sponge. They just lasted forever and ever. There was never an end to them, like rain and precipitation coming out of the clouds, that the aquifers recharged every year, and they acted like a sponge, and then they filled up every year, and then when they were full, they came out in the form of springs and creeks and so on, and rivers, and it flowed back into the ocean, and there was a continuing cycle. I thought it was just a part of the natural cycle. Come to find out now that that's not exactly true. Not exactly true. It's kind of like global warming, you know. We always assume that the polar caps have always been there. They will always be there. Now we find out that they're melting. How far this melting is going to go, nobody seems to know. But about 100 years ago, we started tapping into, here in the United States, the Oglala Aquifer, which covers about 175,000 square miles here in the United States. It's about 200 feet thick, 175,000 square miles. It's got a lot of water in it. We've been tapping that water. We've used 80% of it. And now we find out that in the next 20 years, it's going to go dry. The tragedy here is that 40% of American agriculture depends upon that aquifer. 40%. Now, just take a 40% cut in your income. Just wake up one day, and your paycheck is cut by 40% permanently. That doesn't mean that you're going to die. Doesn't mean that the end of the world has come. It means that you're going to have a 40% cut in your standard of living, though. And that's about where we Americans are headed. We're headed for a 40% decline in our standard of living. That's what the bottom line is. It's not just America. It's around the world. The Indians and the Chinese are having the same problem. Now, there's about 186,000 cubic miles of fresh water a year precipitated down upon the earth. And some of that water goes back into the water table, and it does, in fact, recharge to those aquifers. But not all aquifers are recharged that way, and we're drawing the water out of the aquifers faster than it can go back into them. Now, you don't have to be a real metal giant to figure out that at some indefinite time in the future, we're going to run out of water in those aquifers. You know, if you had $100,000 in the bank, and you were putting money in the bank at the rate of $10,000 a year and drawing it out at the rate of $20,000 a year, it wouldn't take you very long to figure out that in about 10 years, my $100,000 is going to be totally consumed. That doesn't mean that you're broke today. That doesn't mean that you have to change your standard of living today, but it means that at some indefinite time in the future, that $10,000 that you're putting into the bank every year and that $20,000 that you're taking out of your account every year is going to come to an ultimate conclusion. The day is going to come when there will be no money left in your account. And at that point in time, you're going to have a drastic reduction in your standard of living. And the same thing is true here with drawing the water out of the ground. Now, if we had a continual big sugar daddy who was putting money in the bank and we were taking it out of the bank at a lesser rate. For instance, you're putting money in the bank at the rate of $10,000 a year, but you're drawing it out at the rate of $9,000 a year, and you're starting with $100,000. Well, in 10 or 20 years, you're going to have $110,000 or $120,000 in the bank. It's going to continually grow. You're always going to have that cushion to rely upon. That's where most people want to be. Unfortunately, in our water policies around the world, we have been living like drunken sailors who just hit port, and we're in the process of spending our paycheck, and we don't intend to leave town until it's all gone. Well, there's an ultimate outcome that comes from that. And down in the desert southwest here in the United States, we've had archaeological evidence of large societies or civilizations of people, not as large as they are today by any stretch of the imagination, but pretty large, many thousands of people living in cliff dwellings, ran across drought. They had irrigation projects. Drought came and drove them out. Now, can you picture cities like Las Vegas or Denver or Phoenix being abandoned like New Orleans? You know, it's kind of a wild thought, you know. Gee, we have to leave Phoenix because there's not enough water, or the city of Phoenix has to drastically cut back on its population because there simply isn't enough water to take care of everybody. I know, first of all, you'll stop watering your lawns, and then secondly, you'll stop watering your golf courses and so on. But, you know, the number of people moving into Phoenix is growing every year, which means that Phoenix needs more water every year, which means Phoenix has to pump more water out of the aquifer every year. And then on top of that, you've got a drought going on down there, and the Colorado River is producing less water every year, not more, not even the same amount. It's less and less. So you've got more and more demand and less of the resource. You know, at some point in time, you know, without being too bright, you don't need too many letters after your name to figure out that, hey, this isn't going to go on forever, and that probably we ought to take some kind of action in advance of it. For instance, as a businessman, I would take a look at Phoenix, Arizona, and say to myself, over the long term, how is this going to affect my property values? How is this going to affect my business here in Phoenix? Should I relocate? Should I move my business, my family, and my home from Phoenix to Jacksonville, Florida, or maybe to some other location? During World War II, or in this case, before World War II, many Jews left Germany before 1939. We were leaving in 35, 36, 37. Albert Einstein was a notable example. He left in 35. He could see the writing on the wall. He said, you know, if I stay here, my future isn't nearly as bright as it could be if I moved to England or the United States or someplace else. And so he did, and he was one of the survivors. If he had stayed there, he'd just be one of the victims. You can just rest assured that would have been the event. And so as a farmer, I have to look ahead to the future. I have to plan on how much hay I'm going to have to buy this summer to feed my cows next winter. Sometimes we have to figure a year or two or three in advance, depending upon the weather conditions and how long this drought's going to last. What are the prices going to be? Should I cut down on the size of my herd? Those are planning vehicles that we have to get into our heads, you know, ahead of the fact. I can't wait until next January to figure out that I'm out of hay, and I'll just run down to Walmart and buy a few tons. Now, the average Joe Sixpack living in New York City doesn't need to be concerned about water, because that's already planned by some expert someplace. They figure that they're going to have water delivered to the city and that you're going to have water in your tap. And there doesn't seem to be a shortage of water in New York City, but there is a shortage of water out on the Great Plains. And there is a shortage of water out in the West. And that's something to take stock of. And furthermore, it's not just in those two locations, it's worldwide. And it's a depreciable asset. If you want to invest in something, you want to be investing in water. Oil's good, natural gas is good, but water is going to be even better. You know, we can live without gasoline, we can't live without water. Now, the Chinese have a problem, and I brought this up in the last program. Listen to this. One prospective source of food for export to China is called the Mekong Basin in Southeast Asia. The basin begins where the Mekong River leaves the mountains at the Thailand-Myanmar border, and it comprises the floodplain of the Mekong River in parts of Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Well, back in 1956, a Mekong committee comprising representatives of the four riparian countries was established with a secretariat provided by the UN Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East. They did it in Bangkok, Thailand. So they studied conceptual plans that had been developed by the riparian countries with significant input from expert engineers from the U.S. government agencies, like the Corps of Army Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, and the Tennessee Valley Authority. The conceptual plan was a vast scheme involving a cascade of seven dams on the Mekong River, associated power, hydropower, river navigation for 1,000 kilometers inland from the sea, and diversion of waters for extensive irrigation development throughout the basin. Well, the construction of many dams on tributary rivers and water supply to cities and towns and flood control was a great idea that was interrupted by the Vietnam War. Well, back in 1964, I became interested and involved in the Mekong project when I went to Thailand as a UN advisor on dam design and hydropower. And at the time, there was great enthusiasm to get on with the Mekong project and wonderful international cooperation. Some excellent and extensive investigatory studies had been made on many aspects of the project by experts from friendly nations, all under the umbrella of the United Nations. For example, the United States, Japan, Israel, Australia, France, and other countries were active in programs of assistance in planning and evaluation. In addition, there were offers of support from many countries for participation in the construction of the project. Overall, it was a wonderful example of international cooperation and action. For my part, I was delighted to share in the work with my Thai colleagues and to collaborate with experts from so many countries. Now, at the beginning of 1965, it all seemed to stop. The war in Vietnam halted any prospect of the project continuing even on-site investigations on the main river dam sites. Shots were sometimes fired at the operators of drilling rigs in the middle of the river, lessening enthusiasm for international cooperation. The World Bank was quite firm in refusing to fund any part of the project while hostilities continued. Later, these hostilities in Cambodia, especially the genocide and the laying of vast numbers of landmines, did not encourage any construction activity in that country for the foreseeable future. And the effect was to stop all work on the key parts of the project for more than 40 years. Recently, however, the Chinese government announced an intense interest in funding and building the entire scheme, the entire project. And they sought the cooperation of the riparian countries. The Chinese were quite clear that they wanted to create a new food bowl for the world, and especially for China. Now, the Chinese government indicated that there would be no need for funding from international sources such as the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank. The Chinese were prepared to fund the project and to undertake the design and the supervision of construction of all of the major dams and hydropower plants. The total cost of all of those parts of the Mekong project in the four riparian countries will probably be much more than $100 billion. The offer of such large funds is a strong incentive to these riparian countries to accept the Chinese proposals. Now, of course, the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank would also welcome the Chinese proposal as it frees bank funds for other purposes. For upstream, or far upstream, on the Mekong River in China, near Tibet, the Chinese government is now constructing a 290-meter-high concrete arch dam, a project which includes a large hydroelectric power plant, and it will be the highest dam in the world. The project is likely to be followed by a cascade of hydropower dams down the river towards the Mekong Basin. These two great projects to be funded by the Chinese government, the North-South River diversions in China and the Mekong project, illustrate the urgent concern about future food supplies for China and the magnitude of the extraordinary problems that have been created by the exploitation of the Chinese groundwater resources towards extinction. All right, so the Chinese government over here is planning some of the biggest water projects in the history of the world. And while the Chinese are planning these huge projects, the Americans, that is those of us here in the United States, we're talking about taking out the dams on the Columbia River. There are serious proposals here in America to take out those dams. In fact, there's a dam out in California called the Hetchy Hetchy Dam, which provides the water for San Francisco, California, a city of about 600,000 or 700,000 people. And this dam also supplies water for about 30 other smaller cities. It's 150 miles long. It's up in the Sierra Mountains. And here's the funny part of it. San Francisco, which sits down at sea level, this dam is sitting up at 7,000 feet. It's in Yellowstone National Park. It was built there in 1911. This dam supplies San Francisco and 30 other cities, and it's all gravity-fed. There's no pumps in the system. No, they don't have to pump a drop. And there are serious proposals to tear the dam out so that they can have more scenic, wild country, as if there isn't enough, in the midst of a drought. I don't know if Americans have lost their minds or not, but to give you an illustration, the Chinese, at least the Chinese government, looks ahead to the future and says, you know, we got 1.3 billion people today. Our population is growing at about 1% a year. Over time, there's going to be more people with greater demand for food. We're depleting our underground resources. We have to come up with a solution, and they're proposing solutions. In America, they're proposing to take out the six dams on the Columbia River and the Hetch Hetchy Dam up in the Sierras. What are they going to replace that water with? I don't know. I haven't got a clue. But that's the proposal, and these are serious proposals. The governor of California is contemplating taking out that Hetch Hetchy Dam, and I don't know whose idea and who's looking into this thing on the Columbia River. It would seem like to me, now I'm just an old country boy here, but I need some water projects here. So I took a look at one of the natural gullies that's on my place, where a stream runs down through there. And I'm thinking like the Chinese. I'm thinking about building dams across that called step ponds, so that when it rains, I can catch that water and I can hold it behind these little catch dams, these little catch ponds, which would conserve that water. Today, when it rains, in about 3 days, all of the water is run off the land and it runs down to the lake. And that's good for Bull Shoals Lake. They get all the water. What I'm thinking about doing is to put these dams on my property and to hold that water on my property for my use and for my cattle, rather than to depend upon that groundwater, which if all of us are pumping this water out of the ground here, at some point in time, we're going to pump this water out again like we've already done twice in the past. I mean, we went from 40 feet to 120 feet to 300 feet. We're now down to 500 feet, and in 30 years, we'll be down to 1,000. So my little pea brain up here says, oh my God, we cannot forever depend upon groundwater. We had better start thinking about the future. And I'm just a crummy farmer out here in the Ozarks. Now the Chinese are running a bigger operation, and they're sitting there saying, hey, listen, we got a problem, we got to solve it. The Americans are sitting over here saying, we don't have a problem, and we need more wilderness. Now I want to ask you people out in California, when was the last time you went up to the Hetch Hetchy Dam? Hell, I didn't even know it was there until I read about it in National Geographic magazine. I couldn't find the Hetch Hetchy Dam or the Hetch Hetchy Basin if you gave me a road map at high noon and directions. That's how far that thing is up in the mountains. And they want to drain this dam so that they'll have this valley up here for a natural wilderness area. I mean, have you people out there in California totally lost control of your faculties? I'll bet you there isn't 1,000 people in California that could find that damn place. And you get 30 million people out there, of which about 1 million of them depend upon the water from this dam, and you're gonna rip this thing out for 1,000 people to go hiking? Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success out there in California, but don't send me a letter and tell me that you need water from Missouri when you're thirsty. Now, we got a problem here in Missouri, and we're not short of water here, at least not yet. But, you know, if you look into the future, there's going to come a time when we need to be thinking about it. Now, India comes into play. And the reason I'm bringing up China and India, do you know how many people live over here in China and India? About one-third of all the people that draw breath on planet Earth live in those two countries. Now, boys and girls, when those people get hungry, they're going to be looking for food. And they might be looking for food down there in Melbourne and Canberra or Wellington. You Australians ought to be thinking about that. You know, the Japanese were. See, the Japanese live on these little islands up to the north of you. And you know, there's 130 million of them living on a piece of ground up there that's about the size of California. Now, California is a pretty big piece of real estate. It's 158,000 square miles. There's 30 million people, 30, 60, 90, 120. There's four times that many people living in Japan. And it's pretty obvious that the people in Japan don't have the Central Valley of California to feed themselves with. And then in addition to that, they need breathing space. They got to have more room. So that's why in World War II, they took a look at China and said, you know, we think we'll just go take away Manchuria. And they did. Never occurred to you that Chinese might just say that of New Zealand and Australia? We'll just go down here and take it away from those guys. And that's why I think this is pretty important. You know, you might be thinking about this for the future. And it also fits with Bible prophecy. That's another factor to keep in mind here. I brought that up on the first program. I said, now listen, the Messiah said that we've got a time coming here when there would no life be left on planet Earth. So I pointed out to you that there was four or five ways for us to kill ourselves. Nuclear war is very prominent in Bible prophecy. So is famine. Now, while nothing is said about drought in the four horsemen of the apocalypse, it's now been brought clearly to my attention that if you're drawing the water out of the aquifers to produce your food and the aquifers are going dry, that spells famine. And I can't think of a better business to be in than food in a famine. Food in a famine. And for you Australians, that's great for business. But you need to be able to produce enough food down there to keep those Indians and those Chinese at bay. Because when they run out and they don't have prospects of being able to buy any, I'm sure that they're going to cast their covetous eyes on your piece of real estate. And while we Americans are thinking about more wilderness for a few people to gaze at and tearing out dams here in the United States, the Chinese have a more empire mentality. They're thinking about building projects. They're thinking about empire. They're thinking about world domination. And that's the difference between an ascending society and a degenerating society. You know, the Roman Empire reached its peak and then it degenerated. The American Empire has reached its peak and we're in the process of degeneration. So you might want to tuck that away in your thinking, in your planning for the future. Let's take a look at India. In India, there's been an enormous increase in irrigation from deep groundwater over the past 50 years. And India is mining aquifer waters in virtually every state in the country. And water tables are steadily falling, and in some cases by 1 meter a year. Now, a meter is 39 inches. Now, I pointed out to you the other day, I got 290 feet of water in my well. That's the new well. 290 feet of water is in the well. Let's take 290 feet. Let's divide that by 3. And that's 96. So if I was losing 1 meter per year, it would take me 96 years to draw that water out of there. You can rest assured, boys and girls, and I'm going to have Newton out here next year and the year after and the year after to measure the standing water in the well to see how fast it's dropping. See, we never paid attention to that in the past. When you turn the water faucet on and there's water, there's no need to measure how much is in the well. Now, the people in India need to start measuring because I don't know how much they're starting off with to start with. You know, when you've got an inexhaustible supply, now that makes you feel real good. And then one day when you wake up and find out it's not nearly as inexhaustible as you thought it was, now all of a sudden you got to start thinking about the future. The Chinese are thinking about the future. The Americans aren't. Now, the population of India is well over 1 billion people and increasing, and there were 1 million wells with pumps in 1960. Now there's 21 to 26 million groundwater wells. Now, think of that. In 1960, there was 1 million wells in India. Today, there's somewhere between 21 and 26 million groundwater wells. So we've got 20 times as many wells. The population hasn't grown by 20 times, but the consumption of water has. Now, these groundwater wells, with 55 to 60% of the population dependent upon groundwater, which is about normal for the world. About half the people in the world are dependent upon groundwater. And the groundwater is being used up. Well, that spells disaster to me. Now, it just so happens that in the Great Depression, back in the 1930s, we also had a massive drought at the same time. And I just wonder here, at the climax, at the end of the age, if we're going to have depression and drought at the same time. I'm betting on it. And in case you're thinking about Jesus protecting you from this, remember in 1 Samuel chapter 8, he already told you, he said, you'll cry out to me in that day and I won't hear you. So I think we're pretty much on our own. I think you better start making some plans for the future. I was talking to an old buddy of mine out in California the other day. And he's a pretty good old boy, but he's not thinking much about the future, especially the future in California. Now, I'm from California. California would be one of the last places that I'd want to hold up waiting for the Great Tribulation. Not that every place in California is bad, but, you know, 31 million people living on a piece of real estate over there that's in the midst of a drought, water shortages, and filled with all kinds of liberal dinglings. I don't know. No, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. I certainly wouldn't tell somebody, you know, that didn't ask me. I certainly wouldn't tell them, you know, what they ought to be doing. That's none of my business. I don't give people advice, not unless they ask for it. But, you know, day in and day out, you have a problem. You've got to feed your family on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. You got to feed your family in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2010, 2015. I mean, I don't care what the geopolitical circumstances are. You still got to be feeding your family, and you've got to be making a living and doing your thing in life. Now, the Jews had to face that in 1935. They had that same problem in 35, 36, 37, 38, 39. Some of them took a look at the trend and said, well, based upon this trend line, there's no future here for me. And as disgusting, as displeasing as this is, the thought of me having to leave, I better start entertaining that. And I'm thinking about that in the case of Denver and Phoenix and Las Vegas. And, of course, today, when you've got plenty of water, people say, you know, you're some kind of a nut. You won't be saying that when you run out of water. And your property values aren't going to be nearly as good when there's bad news. I mean, who in the hell wants to buy a house in Phoenix, Arizona, when there's water rationing? And, you know, you're not going to get too many people thinking about Phoenix, Arizona, or Tucson, wanting to move there, you know, from Bangor, Maine, or from Miami, Florida, if there's a water shortage. Then you're already in the water shortage. And it isn't just in those locations either, boys and girls. It's worldwide, and it's in the not-too-distant future, 20 years. And let me give you your reminder here at the Midway Point. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited on The Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about The Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call The Law School Director, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about depletion of groundwater resources. This particular article comes from the Executive Intelligence Review, called EIR. And it's at www.larouchepub.com. That's all one word, LAROUCHEPUB.com. Talking about India, the Indian agricultural economy prospered from the benefits of this abundant, free, and clear groundwater. Groundwater irrigation expanded to create more agricultural wealth than any other irrigation source. Irrigation from groundwater had many advantages. The farmers could use the groundwater when and where they needed it. This improved prosperity enabled them to use higher yielding crops, fertilizers, and pest control, making the use of groundwater far more productive and thereby causing increasing dependence on groundwater. As a consequence, a great groundwater economy has been created in India over the past 50 years. It has now reached its maximum level of development and is starting to decline, and it's declining rapidly in many areas. The overexploitation of groundwater has led to declining water levels, drying of shallow aquifers, and saltwater intrusion. The deeper groundwater wells are highly mineralized, and in some parts of India, the population is now suffering fluoride poisoning and arsenic poisoning. It is evident that India faces a terrible calamity as the groundwater economy limps to a standstill. Half the country's traditional hand-dug wells have already run dry, as have millions of bored wells. And many farmers have borrowed money to spend on new wells, only to find that they did not flow. Because of the risks involved, the money had to be borrowed at high interest rates. The consequent inability to repay borrowings has led to suicide. Urgent action is now planned by the Indian government. They have approved a plan to use water from the rivers flowing from the Himalayas for diversion south to replenish 17 southern rivers and to be distributed over much of the Indian peninsula. The project is based on using the waters of 14 tributaries of the Ganges and the Brahmatura rivers. I guess that's the way to pronounce it. The scheme involves some 300 reservoirs, 12,000 kilometers of canals, and will divert a total flow of 1,500 cubic meters a second. The estimated cost is from $70 to $200 billion. Could be twice what the Chinese are proposing in the Mekong project. And the proposed project has already caused tensions with Bangladesh because it involves diverting rivers which flow through Bangladesh. The Indian government has formed a task force to implement the project with a completion date of 2016, and it will be an enormous task to complete the project in that period of time. On the other hand, the provision of a secure supply of water to the people of India is now a matter of crucial human and economic importance to the nation and to the world. All right, now there's the two most populous countries in the world facing water shortages. In fact, the water shortages promise to be a calamity. It's a calamity because you have now built the cities of Phoenix out in the desert. It's already there. The infrastructure, the buildings, the streets and the highways and the houses and the homes are already there, dependent upon groundwater, which is going to end at some point in time. Boys and girls, Phoenix is not a good place for the long term. Neither is Las Vegas. Now, Las Vegas is in a much better position because they're only about 10 miles away from Lake Mead. So therefore, they've got Hoover Dam, and that probably will be the saving grace. I mean, if we have to decide between agriculture and the city of Las Vegas, I'm pretty sure that we're going to save Las Vegas. But unfortunately, the Colorado River is not big enough, does not have enough flow for everybody, like Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. I mean, you know, that's just where reality is located. Now, you know, Bible prophecy talks about this, and it talks about famine on a worldwide scale in which one-fourth of the people on planet Earth are going to be affected. One-fourth are going to die from the famine. Well, that's a bundle of people. You know that? Let's just take a look at it. 6 billion people in the world, 6 billion, take a fourth of that, and that's 1.5 billion, isn't it? 1.5, 3, 4.5, 6. Boys and girls, we've never lived in a time when we saw 1.5 billion people die. And I don't believe that 1.5 billion people are just going to starve to death quietly. And those 1.5 billion people that we're talking about there live in China and India. I just don't see those people just quietly dying while you people in Phoenix and Las Vegas, you know, spend your time in the casinos, eating it up and having a good time, Now, they may, and it may just be a problem that we don't need to be concerned about, but I think that we'd be better advised to prepare for it and hope that it doesn't happen. Now, Bangladesh comes in here. Bangladesh used to be East Pakistan. Pakistan was divided up, if you'll remember, from India. At the end of the British rule, they came up with a Pakistan. Pakistan was divided east and west, and then later on, I don't know exactly when, back in 1970 sometime, the people in East Pakistan decided to split from the people in West Pakistan. So if you'll take a look up the Bay of Bengal, I believe it is, and you'll see this little country called Bangladesh. I think it's the most densely populated country in the world. Most densely populated country in the world, if I remember right. Little country, about 140 million people jammed into this little piece of ground over here. Pretty low ground too, kind of like Holland. And those people are running out of water. Can you believe this? Listen up. Bangladesh has a population of 141 million as of July 2004, and it has the highest population density in the world, other than the city-states such as Hong Kong and Singapore. And yet, Bangladesh is a rural economy with most of the people working in the agricultural sector. So it's a low-lying country on the delta of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra River, however you pronounce it. About one-third of the country floods annually during the monsoon season. My God, can you picture this? You're living in a country with 140 million people, the most densely populated country in the world. Every year, a third of it floods. So that means a third of us have to move off of our ground and move on to your ground every year until the floodwaters go down. Bangladesh came into existence originally as Bengali East Pakistan after the partition of India in 1950. It became a separate country in 1971 when it seceded from the union with West Pakistan. As an ethnic group, the people are almost entirely Bengali, and 83% of the population is Muslim. Almost the entire land border is with India, and relations between the two countries are tense. Tense. 140 million people. With tense. It is an extremely poor country, and until the 1970s, the people in the countryside were largely dependent for their water supply on surface water ponds and rivers. With increasing population, the surface ponds became highly polluted. Sewage bacteria unleashed waterborne diseases, which killed a quarter of a million children every year. The United Nations became concerned about this dreadful calamity, and the Children's Emergency Fund, called UNICEF, sought to solve the problem by installing a great number of water wells in order to replace dangerous surface waters with clean groundwater. The economic impact of the mass introduction of groundwater wells was very dramatic. The contribution of groundwater to the total irrigated area increased from 4% in 1971 to 70% in 1999. I'm going to put exclamation points there like the Magombo. I'm going to put brackets around the paragraph. Now, boys and girls, let's pay attention here to what the numbers tell us. Because, you know, I'm an old-timey businessman. And if I was sitting here at my desk and I'm looking at this problem, And I'm saying, what's the solution to this problem? My God, boys and girls, this is an insoluble problem. I mean to tell you, there isn't a solution to this. I mean, this attacks God Almighty himself. I mean, he'd have to sit down and mull this one over for 5 minutes. Poor little old country boys like me take a look at a problem like this and say, oh my God. Now listen to these numbers again. The economic impact of the mass introduction of groundwater wells was very dramatic. And the contribution of groundwater to the total irrigated area increased from 4% in 1971 to 70% in 1999. These people in Bangladesh now, 70% of their irrigation water comes from groundwater. These people have a 70% dependency. Now, worldwide, it's 50%. These people have 70% dependence. Some 12 million wells were installed. Employment and output in agriculture increased. Poverty was reduced. The United Nations saved the children. No, boys and girls, they have set up a problem over here that's going to kill about 100 million people. I mean, you're going to look at a problem here in the future, a mass dying of people, simply because their water table is running down. Now, it could well be, you know, if you've got 20 years to prepare for this, in 20 years you could probably do quite a bit. But these people aren't preparing. They're like people in New York City. Why prepare for something that we don't know anything about? Why prepare for something that probably isn't going to happen? I mean, you know, in most people's minds, this just blows your mind away. You can't envision these people running out of water. Well, I don't make these numbers. I don't know. Is this guy lying to us? This is called the intelligence. They call this executive intelligence review. So whenever we get a topic or a subject like this, to make sure that it's not just an urban legend, that this isn't just some kook, I sent Dirk in. I said, Dirk, groundwater, groundwater. Is there a problem with groundwater? He looked at me and said, groundwater? What's the matter with groundwater? What's the problem? I said, I don't know. My God, read this. He read it. He went back to the computer. Here's the groundwater drawdown by Callie Orm. World's largest aquifer going dry, U.S. Water News Online. Land subsidence, earth fissures change Arizona's landscape caused by the drawdown of groundwater. I got a number of articles here for this series of programs. I mean, we just went to the Internet. Now, boys and girls, you know, I sit here at a news desk. I have news reports that come across here constantly, and I'm looking at these reports, and I see I'm pretty well informed. I thought I was. I'm telling you, kids, as of 1 week ago, I never knew there was a problem with groundwater. It never even entered my mind. Now, all of a sudden, somebody brought to my attention groundwater, and I said, well, let me read the story. Then I've corroborated it through three separate sources, and I'm looking at the problem, and I'm saying this is an insoluble problem. This is Revelation chapter 6. We are looking at the four horsemen right here, boys and girls. Famine, which is going to take a fourth of us. One fourth of mankind is going to die in that famine. And now I can see and understand fully why that's going to happen. Because over the last 50 years, we have tapped into the groundwater supplies. We have changed our entire infrastructure. You know, it's kind of like we Americans. We are totally dependent upon foreign oil. Let me tell you, boys and girls, if the foreigners who ship us our oil, 70% of our oil now comes from overseas. Did you know that? If those people shut off our oil, it's all over for America. Your economy, your job, your way of life is dead, at least for a period of time. Now, that isn't going to kill you. But I want you to picture your life with 70% less gasoline, 70% less heat, 70% less electricity tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. Now, I would venture a guess, and I would say, boys and girls, that it's going to impact you in the same way that it's going to impact me. Now, the difference being that I looked at this problem some years back, and I said, you know, I need to develop a lifestyle that is less dependent upon oil. So when the oil gets shut off, I'm not going to have any more gasoline than you have, probably less. But I don't depend upon that gasoline for my livelihood nearly as much as you do. Let's picture this. This morning I got up at 6 o'clock to come down here to make this program. I have to commute 41 steps from my kitchen to my desk. 41 steps. I didn't use any gasoline at all to go to work this morning. Now, if you're the average American, and you got up, and you got in your automobile, and you drove to work, you may have driven 5, 10, 15, 20 miles. I've got a neighbor over here who commutes 87 miles one way from Isabella, Missouri to Springfield, Missouri. He's a pharmacist, and he has a job in Springfield. He drives to Springfield. It takes an hour and a half to drive to Springfield, an hour and a half to drive back home. 87 miles. Can you believe that? Now, just picture gas rationing. Just picture gasoline being shut off for a period of time. I'll tell you, there's another nightmare that's coming here while we're talking about nightmares here and the end of the world and some bad problem. And we're living in America, boys and girls, where we don't have near the problem they've got in Bangladesh or India or China. But the other day, I got a report, not the other day, but, you know, a couple months ago, had a report here. They're talking about the electric grid here in the United States. The electric grid, it is a very tenuous threat. It's a technological marvel, is what it is. All the states of the United States, and in fact, some of you people up in Canada are tied into this grid too. If out in California, let's say that in Los Angeles, California, it's particularly hot, and people in Southern California are using a lot of electricity to run their air conditioners. And let's suppose that in Portland, Maine, it is particularly cool, and they're not using their air conditioners up in Portland, Maine, and they've got a surplus of electricity. Do you know that they can move that electricity surplus in Portland, Maine to Los Angeles, California in about 30 minutes? It is absolutely phenomenal. I could hardly believe the story. From Portland, Maine to Los Angeles, California, in 30 minutes or less, they can move that power. There's a system in place to do that. And it's this interlocking power grid here in the United States. I don't know if you've got it in Europe. I don't know if you've got it in Australia. But boy, we've got it here. Boy, you talk about technology now. That's marvelous, isn't it? And that's what helps keep the electric rates low. And it's what keeps the electricity on. Because, you know, if you people were consuming too much in Southern California, you start having brownouts. So fortunately, they can move electricity all around the United States where there's a shortage. And it really works well because, you see, there's less power being used at 10 o'clock at night in New York City. So they can move that power from New York City clear out to the West Coast 4 hours later because out in the West Coast, you know, it's 6 o'clock. And so when they're using peak power out in the West Coast, they can take it from New York because they're using less power there. It's a hell of a technological marvel, isn't it? Now watch this. Here's your Achilles heel. The system's gone down three times since 1970. It's gone down three times in regional areas where it gets knocked offline. They're talking about a possibility that this thing could knock out the whole electric grid in the United States. If they had something go haywire. I mean, what if you had a couple of three terrorists get hold of the electric grid, you know, in a couple of key locations? I'll bet you that there's two or three Muslims. I'll bet you there's two or three Muslim Arabs that work for some electric utility someplace. You know, the people that strap bombs on themselves and blow themselves up, I don't think would have any problem flipping a switch someplace, now, would they? And you flip the wrong switch at the wrong place and it knocks a power plant out, and then it sends a surge down the power lines and knocks out the next power plant and knocks out. It's like dominoes. And they said there is every reason to believe that the entire power grid in the United States at some point in time, because of the fragility of the system, it isn't quite like the red telephone that the president has, you know, the fail-safe nuclear safeguards. They don't have fail-safe on the electric grid. And they tell us that it's just a matter of time until that thing gets knocked offline. Can you imagine the United States of America with no electricity for up to 30 days? They say it'll take 30 days to get the entire grid back up and running. 30 days to get the grid back up and running in America? Boys and girls, I can't picture a calamity like that. I couldn't picture airplanes flying into buildings. You know, there are things in life that are so wicked, that are so evil, that are so despicable that in normal people, I guess I'm normal, it doesn't even register. It doesn't go into your brain. How in the hell could you even envision such a thing as somebody hijacking an airplane and then killing a whole bunch of people with me as I fly it into a building? I mean, it's just, you know, beyond imagination. Well, trying to imagine the entire electric system going down in America is beyond the capacity of most of us. But boys and girls, there are people in the system that are paid to think about that and to prevent that from happening. There are people around the world that are familiar with the aquifers and the drawdown of the water supplies in the world. There are some people that are charged with that job. And this imagination-defying problem in Bangladesh, they've moved from 4% groundwater to 70% by 1999. And you can rest assured that they're boring new wells in Bangladesh every day. Just like old Newton drilling, they got well drillers out there poking holes in the ground to draw that water out even faster. Boys and girls, that's not the solution. That's the problem. And it's going to come back and bite them. Now, when 140 million people over there are starving to death, they're already in a tense, it's described here as tense, border relationship with India. I can picture 100 million hungry people over there getting real tense. I think if I was hungry, I'd get real tense. And boys and girls, when you get hungry, you're liable to get real tense also. Well, we'll take it up right there when we come back here next time. We're talking about Bangladesh and the depletion of the water table around the world as it relates to this thing of Bible prophecy, and particularly these four horsemen of the apocalypse. You can read about that in Revelation chapter 6. That's one of those imagination-defying chapters, just beyond description. All right, we're about out of time here, so let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, just go to our webpage. It's georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Remember, for more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.